Everything's great. Okay, well, I want to just thank Wade for both inviting me and introducing me so nicely. Thank you very much. I also want to thank Aurelia and Bernadette, who I've never met in person, for organizing everything behind the scenes and making all the arrangements. I'm really, really happy to be here with you tonight. So Wade introduced me very well, and I wanted to just start off by getting you to know me a little bit better. So as Wade said, I run a lab called ABLE, or the Aquatic Behavioral Ecology Laboratory. And that's because we do most of our work on fishes. I do mostly work on things like the evolution of cooperation. Why do we see cooperation or social behavior in some species and not others, or some individuals and not others? And we mainly work on cichlids from Lake Tanganyika to address these questions. We also do a lot of work in my lab on fish breeding systems, asking questions about why some species provide parental care and other fish species don't, or things about why fish choose particular individuals as mates or compete in particular ways, including sperm competition. And we mainly use this really weird toadfish on the Pacific coast called the plainfin midshipman, which is a deep sea fish but comes to shore, to address these questions. But for a long time, I've also been really interested in human impacts and what we do as a species that affects the planet and therefore the animals that live on this planet with us, and how we're changing animal behavior. And it's that work that I'm going to talk to you about tonight. So I'm going to go really local. I'm going to take you to Hamilton Harbor. This is the westernmost tip of Lake Ontario, the easternmost of the five Great Laurentian Lakes. And the first European who is thought to have set eyes on this body of water is someone called Étienne Brûlé, who was a French fur trapper. And it's thought that he came here sometime around September of 1616. He worked with Champlain, and he was someone who they sent out to scout and look at this area. But of course, there were lots of First Nations that were living here much longer than that, especially the Hurons, the Iroquois, and the Neutral people. And they called this area Mikasa Bay, which means still or beautiful, or still beautiful waters. And the harbor has actually had lots of different names over time. It's been called Lake Geneva, Head of the Lake, Burlington Bay, and as we know it now, Hamilton Harbor. And this area was an absolute natural paradise. This is a painting done by Elizabeth Simcoe, who was the wife of the first lieutenant governor of Upper Canada, John Graves Simcoe. And in her sketch, you can see what a beautiful area this was. And about 50 years later, there was another painting that we have of the area by a painter called John Herbert Caddy, and he also showed Hamilton Harbor to be an absolutely beautiful natural wonderland, a somewhat marshy lake in this gorgeous picture. And even today, there are parts of Hamilton Harbor that are spectacular and natural and beautiful. But the harbor has also changed. And one of the main reasons it's changed is because a channel was cut into our beach strip, a deep channel, which opened up the harbor for shipping. And this was done in 1823, and it made Hamilton into the port city it is today. We have about 600 ships that come to our harbor every year. And it led to huge economic growth and industrialization and development of our harbor. So after this channel is cut, Hamilton Harbor, because of this quiet, safe harbor and the access to railway, really grows. And many, many industries set up shop in the early 1900s right here in the bay. And among them are Stelco and DeFasco, two steel manufacturing companies. They were formed in 1910, or they came here in 1910 and 1912, respectively. And the city really becomes a manufacturing hub. Businesses like Procter & Gamble moved here, Beech Nut Packing Company moved in. The second ever Canadian Tire came to Hamilton around those years. It really, really started growing. Unfortunately, because there were no pollution laws until about the 1970s, a lot of the local industry used the harbor as a dumping ground. And especially things like steel mill, agricultural, road runoff has caused a massive change to the harbor. The harbor is the location of something we call Randall Reef, which isn't really a reef at all, but a massive coal tar deposit. And it's the reason why Hamilton Harbor is considered one of the worst polluted aquatic sites in Canada. There's been significant remediation efforts put into making the harbor better and cleaner, but before 1970, there really weren't any laws about this. And so today, we still have lots of contaminants in our harbor, and especially in our harbor's sediments, that are way beyond what Environment Canada considers safe. And the ones that I've listed in red are the ones that are still elevated in the harbor sediments. But it's really important to remember that it's not the whole harbor that's homogeneously contaminated. The harbor has hot spots of contamination. Some areas are cleaner, some areas are more polluted. And what you can see in this picture is a picture of the PAHs, one organic contaminant that is sort of very heterogeneously in the sediments. So the white refers to really, really polluted areas, and as it gets darker, it actually gets cleaner in the sediments. It's not just industry, but also wastewater that's polluting our harbor. I've circled in yellow here the three wastewater treatment plants that send their treated effluent into Hamilton Harbor. So there's the Dundas one, really close to where we are now, the Woodward and the Burlington wastewater treatment plant. You can also see all these little red dots. And those little red dots are combined sewer overflow sites. So in a city as old as Hamilton, some of our sewers are combined. So it means that everything that's sewage gets mixed up with the things that go down our drains, like melting rain, melting snow or rainwater. And when there's a big downpour and the wastewater treatment plants can't handle the capacity of water, they'll actually release untreated sewage into the harbor. So we have more contaminants in the harbor because of that. And it's especially clear in the older parts of Hamilton. So all of this led to the decline of the harbor. We see water pollution, high nutrients and sediment from sewage, industrial waste, landfill, all diminishing our harbor. There's also been introduction of different species. There's things like the carp introduction. Carp are bottom feeders and they're very destructive to the plants. And places like Coots Paradise Marsh, which is in the westernmost part of the harbor, were pretty wrecked by the carp introduction. It's thought that 85% of the plant cover was lost because of carp. And about 1930, the harbor is deemed unacceptable, too dangerous for recreational swimming. And in 1987, the harbor is declared one of the areas of concern for the Great Lakes. There's about 40, 42 of these. Hamilton Harbor is designated for that, and they start remediation. So what I'm going to talk to you guys about tonight is about what happens when an invasive species hits a polluted environment like Hamilton Harbor. But before I jump into that, I'm gonna just make sure we're all on the same page when I use the term invasive species. What am I talking about? Well, what I mean is a species that's non-native, that's being moved or has managed to move somehow into a new area, and it becomes more abundant and spreads and begins to cause harm. It can cause harm to the ecosystem, the environment, the ecology, to human health, or even to the economy. Not all exotic species that aren't supposed to be here are actually invasive. Some are not. But there are lots and lots of invasive species. Close to 4,000 have been clocked on our planet. This is just a small group of them that you're probably fairly aware of because they cause such damage. On this slide, I've tried to show why this is happening and why this is happening at such accelerated rates. Why do we see so many invasive species? And that's because the way we transport goods has really broken down the biogeographical boundaries that used to be there for species. So on this map, you can see the world, the planet. And on the land masses that you can probably barely make out in a kind of gray are a bunch of pink dots, many, many, many of them, because these represent highways and roads that really crisscross almost all our continents. In red, you can see the shipping lanes that move goods from one part of the globe to the other. So really through transport and stowaways and accidental introductions, we've seen really biogeographical boundaries diminish and lots of invasives come in. So an invasive species is a non-native species that's causing harm to the environment, to the economy, to human health in its new habitat. And invasive species are considered one of the main threats to biodiversity. After habitat loss, I would argue invasive species do the most damage. Things like zebra mussels clog up pipes and foul our equipment and make it really hard for things to work. We have things like sea lampreys, which are parasitic and cause great cost to fisheries. And we have things like the mountain pine beetle, which destroys forests and causes higher risk of fires to these dead, from these dead trees. So invasive species generally are inflicting a significant cost to our native ecosystems in terms of disease, in terms of competition with native species, in terms of predation, and in terms of resource depletion. And it's been estimated that aquatic invasives alone, just in a single year, can cost the world something like $345 million to deal with, to mitigate. That's the loss in economically from their impacts. So we now know what an invasive species is, but why are they so successful? They have these traits that make them super successful. And these traits include things like rapid reproduction, really, really fast growth. They're also super tolerant. They can usually manage to live in many different environments, high temperature, low oxygen, high salinity, you name it. They also are, because they're new in their invaded habitats, they're usually released from predators and disease. They're not recognized as something that could be eaten or a host from a pathogen. They're usually very aggressive species and they're active, bold, exploratory. They move a lot, they're spreaders. But before you get too excited about these traits being the whole story, I'm gonna tell you that it also matters where they're put or moved to or where they've moved to on their own. The characteristics of the ecosystem that they enter plays a big role in whether or not this invasion is going to be successful or not. So So they have these traits, but the ecosystems that they're going into also have particular traits. And these traits can dampen or accelerate the success of an invasive species. So something like the species community. If the species community in which they find themselves in is super rich, they won't necessarily get a very good foothold. But if it's impoverished and there's very few species, they tend to do better. If there's lots of resources, invasive species do very, very well. And if they seem to do very well in disturbed habitats, like highly contaminated harbors, like Hamilton Harbor. Now, there are usually classically thought to be four stages of an invasion. The first, or the initial stage, is where the organism is moved or accidentally or on purpose to a new area. And this can happen naturally, but it mostly happens because we do it, accidentally or on purpose. And they become established in this area, which is the second phase. So once they arrive, they have to create a viable, sustaining, self-reproducing population. That's the establishment phase. And then there's a very strong filter at this point, because sometimes they will spread and sometimes they will not. And usually there's a big lag between when they are established and when they actually begin to spread. And finally, after the spread, there's usually an impact stage where they begin to inflict damage on the ecosystem or on us. Now, in a lot of cases, when you have an invasive species, it will go through what we call an accelerated growth phase. So there's a lag, it gets established slowly, and then it grows. They get very, very abundant. And sometimes they even overshoot the carrying capacity of their new habitat. And then they'll either reach equilibrium or they'll go through some kind of bust phase. They have a boom phase where they grow, and then because maybe they've eaten away all their resources or predators have figured out that they're good eating, they'll actually decrease really fast too. And you can continue to cycle that way, or they could reach a new equilibrium. So we have these boom-bust dynamics that we see in a lot of different invasive species. I'm going to tell you about the work that my students and I are doing on this invasive species, the round goby. The round goby has incredible potential for invasiveness because it is tolerant of many different environmental conditions. It also reproduces at a very high rate. It can reproduce 3, 4, 5 times a year, and the males look after the babies, so the babies do very well. They have a really high probability of survival because of that paternal care by the dad, round goby. Well, Wade already gave away this slide. They came from the Ponto-Caspian region of the world, the Caspian Sea, Eastern Black Sea, and they were thought to be transported with ballast water. So in ships, when they take on or release their loads, they also can take on or release water. And through that water source came the round gobies. When they arrived, it was 1990 in the Great Lakes. They arrived in the early 1990s, that's when they were first detected. And around the same year, they were also detected in the Baltic. And they spread all through the Baltic, and then for a while were kind of quiet in Europe. But in the last 10, 15 years, they've gone ballistic in Europe. And they've started really moving westwards. They're now in all the major rivers in Europe. They've reached Holland, France, you name it. And this species is not the first aquatic species to invade, and it's not going to be the last, sadly, but there are reasons why we should be particularly worried about the round goby. And that's because it's a really, really fast invader. So it spread incredibly fast. You can see a little black box at the bottom that's going to show you the date. And you're going to see how they spread from Lake St. Clair, which is on the edge of Lake Erie, through the Great Lakes, and how quickly they did it. I'm going to try to make this work. I hope it works. Can you see things jumping up on your screens? So they've gone through all the Great Lakes in about the space of 5-6 years. They're now moving all the way up the St. Lawrence River. They've really invaded incredibly fast. Now, why is this surprising? Why is this concerning? Well, it was really surprising to scientists because this is a small benthic fish that has no swim bladder and is a really crappy swimmer. The fact that they have no swim bladder means that they cannot maintain their buoyancy very well, and they're not really in the water column at all. They stay on the ground and they stay there with a suction cup that's made out of their pelvic fins, and they jump, kind of, they hop a little bit, like frogs. So they don't really swim very fast, they have a really small home range, and no one predicted that this fish would spread as fast as they did or as widely as they did. They have considerable damage on the ecosystem in which they find themselves in. So we find that native species that share habitats and food sources, things like the mottled sculpin or Johnny Darters or log perch, are not doing very well. When there's a lot of gobies around, those species are not doing very well. They also eat the eggs and young of a bunch of our sport fish, and they're also eaten by those sport fish as adults. So they eat the young, and these top predators also eat them. But unfortunately, they're very good at eating zebra mussels, draenid mussels, which are very good filter feeders and sequester lots and lots of contaminants in these zebra mussels. And then what happens is the gobies eat these zebra mussels and release these contaminants or these diseases to top predators. So they carry botulism, they also can have a high contaminant load, as you will see in just a minute. So we have these contaminants that are being sequestered in zebra mussels, and because the round goby is one of the only fishes in the Great Lakes that can eat zebra mussels, they're releasing these contaminants into the food web. The other kind of crazy thing about them is there are two types of males. We have this garter male who looks after the babies and courts females. And we have another kind of male in the population known as a sneaker male. And these sneaker males dash into the nest, drop sperm, and get out. They are usually much smaller. They don't look black. And they do not give courtship or parental care. I call them cads rather than dads. So we have this smaller type of male in the population that sneaks all its fertilizations. There's no courtship and no parental care. And we've been wondering, what does this alternative reproductive tactic do for the invasion dynamics, do for the populations of round goby? So I'm going to really talk for a few minutes now about two different topics that we've been looking at in my lab. My students and I have been interested in understanding what happens when an invasive species like the round goby reaches a polluted harbor like Hamilton Harbor. And we've also been interested in what this reproductive plasticity does for population dynamics of an invasive species. So let's turn to the first question. What happens when an invasive species enters a polluted habitat? And I want you to remember that Hamilton Harbor is not one big homogeneous contaminant area. It's very heterogeneous. And so what my students and I have been doing is we've been tracking the invasion in Hamilton Harbor for about 25 years, 23 years, really. I started in 2002. We track the invasion using something called a minnow trap. We tie these to ropes and we throw them off land, which we tie them to something on land, and we throw them into the harbor. And the traps are baited with corn. The fish love it. There's a big area for them to swim in and a very tiny hole, so they tend to be left in there. And we leave the traps in for 24 hours. We have different sites around the harbor. The blue dots show our cleaner sites where the sediment isn't very contaminated. And the orangey yellow dots show our highly contaminated sites, which are right near the steel mill, right near Randall Reef, right near some of the wastewater treatment effluent outflow. So we use these minnow traps. We use multiple traps in both cleaner areas of the harbor and contaminated areas of the harbor. And when we pull out the fish, we measure them, we weigh them, we open them up, we take tissue samples, we age them, we do all kinds of things. And we've done this now for 23 years. We do it for about 6 months of the year. Every 2 weeks, we go out to those six sites, we come back the next day, we pick them up, we dissect them, we look at them. There's been over 20,000 fish in our data sets, and I'll show you the data in just a minute. So I'm going to tell you about some work that Julie Marantet, one of my previous PhD students, did. She's now working for the DFO, the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, as a science advisor. But Julie found out that their livers in the contaminated areas had a lot of metals. They had things like copper and cadmium, which the fish from cleaner areas didn't have. We also were able to show that their fins were eroded away. So in the contaminated areas, their pelvic fin, which is that suction cup, had much shorter rays. They didn't have as long fins. And you can sort of see that by the black dots that I've sort of indicated that on, the fin, the kind of ventral surface is shorter for this pelvic fin. When we looked at their gonads and their hormones and their genes, we found something else that was really interesting. We found that they had a gene known as vitiligen that was highly expressed in males. But this gene is a precursor for yolk protein. So males shouldn't really have elevated levels of vitiligen, but they did in the contaminated areas. And this suggests a degree of feminization. When we looked at their external genitalia, which is like fish private bits, we found that the females have this nice rounded tabletop genitalia. Males have a cone-like, volcano-like genitalia, but the males from the contaminated areas were intermediate. They didn't look like females and they didn't look like males. They were sort of in between. And when we took out their gonads and we sliced them up and looked under a microscope, we found that many of the males inside their testes had tiny little oocytes, the beginning of eggs. So this is another indication that we have hormone disruption. We have endocrine disruption, which is what happens sometimes when contaminants get into organisms. I had another PhD student who was really interested in looking at what's happening over time in Hamilton Harbor, in the contaminated areas and in the non-contaminated areas. And what you can see here is the different years that we've sampled across the bottom, the x-axis, and on the graph there, you can also see how many gobies we catch per trap in the clean areas in blue and the contaminated areas in yellow. And you can see that there's been a kind of decrease over time. We used to catch about 8 fish per trap. These days we're catching about 3. Maybe that's a good thing. We also are seeing that the reduction is happening in the contaminated areas and also in the clean areas. And statistically, there's no difference there in the decrease rate. But when we look at who we're catching, we're seeing some interesting patterns. So you're looking at males on your right and females on your left. And on the top is how long the fish is, known as standard length. And on the bottom is their mass. How heavy are they? And what you can see here is that males are heavier and bigger than females. Okay, we've known that for a long time in this species and other species. But you can also see that the blue lines are always above the yellow lines. I hope you can sort of see that. And the blue lines being higher than the yellow lines mean that the fish from the cleaner areas are bigger and heavier, longer and heavier than those from the contaminated areas. So we have fish that are smaller in contaminated areas, and the size over time has also decreased. In the early days, we were catching bigger, longer, heavier fish. We're also behavioral people. In my lab, we're all behavioral ecologists, and so we bring the fish in to see how their behavior changes depending on where they came from. So we keep them in the lab after catching them for about 2 days, just letting them acclimate, and then one of the first behaviors we tested was movement and maze, in a maze. So we put them in this really long arena, it's 2.5 meters long, and we ask, how long does it take the fish to move from the first compartment to the end? And on the bottom, you can see that the number of exploratory swims is much higher for the cleaner fish than in the contaminated fish. The contaminated fish are moving less. They're moving out of the first compartment at a much slower rate. They're getting to the end much less often. They're just moving less. We also think they're not as good at getting away from predators when they have a high contaminant load. And that's because we've done two different experiments, and by we, I really mean my students. And one of the experiments that was done was we chased the fish with a net. And we asked, at what point do they get exhausted and stop moving away from the net and let us just scoop them up? Now, the person who was recording this time to exhaustion had no idea where the fish were coming from. She was blind to that origin. And she looked to see when they got exhausted. And what you can see is that the clean fish take longer to exhaust to get scooped up than do the contaminated fish. We also created a robot, just like you. We created a robot that we called RoboFish in our lab, and it would go around and scare the fish. And we asked, how do they respond to that robotic predator that we had in our lab? And what you can see is that the fish in blue, before the attack by the RoboFish, the robotic predator, had an overall higher activity level, which is what I already showed you it from another experiment. And then when the attack happened, both the fish from clean areas and the fish from contaminated areas stopped moving or reduced their movement, and then they slowly started returning back to their movement. But the fish from the contaminated areas reached their slower baseline much, much faster, as if they couldn't sense danger very well. So we think these two experiments together suggest that fish from impacted sites are much more at risk from predators. So let's just sort of summarize that. Fish are, fish abundance and size has decreased over the 25 years that I've been measuring these fish, or the 23 years that I've been looking at this population. There are now many smaller feminized fish in polluted areas, and they are slower and less effective at predator responses or evading predators in polluted areas. And we assume that animals that have a higher contaminant load are also less likely to survive and more likely to get eaten. And this matters because if a fish that's full of contamination gets eaten, then they're moving this up the food web. So let's move on quickly to talk about this reproductive plasticity and how it affects the invasion success. So remember again, there are two types of males in round gobies. There are the garter males that are good dads. They have really fat cheeks. They're really black. And we also have the sneaker males, these lighter female-like fish. And they were discovered here in Hamilton Harbor by Julie Marentette. We now know they're all in every population that we've studied, but initially no one knew that there were these two kinds of males in round gobies, and Julie figured this out. When she looked through her data, she found that the garters were always bigger than the sneakers. So you see the total length, they're also heavier. Garters are bigger fish. The darker, bigger fish are garters. The smaller, lighter fish are sneakers. When she opened them up, she saw some really interesting differences in their reproductive organs. So on this side, you see some female gonads. It's basically an ovary full of yellow eggs, which the gobies have. And then you can see the testes of a garter male, a big male who's going to look after his young. And you can see that there's two paired organs, testes, and then on the bottom, there's what we call accessory glands, or the fish prostate, if you like. And this fish prostate has fluids that look after the sperm and take care of the sperm, seminal fluids. These are sometimes called seminal vesicles. But the sneaker males, although they had pretty big testes for their tiny little size, had no accessory gland to find, or tiny little recessive ones. And this is a graphical version of that. We see that for their size, their relative size of the testes is huge in sneakers. It's pretty much from their throat to their anus. It's all testes. They're swimming bags of testes. And the garters, relatively speaking, are investing less in building testes. Only 1% of their body mass is going to testes, while in the sneakers, it's a much bigger proportion of their whole mass. And when you think about this accessory gland, this gland that's on the end of the testes that mixes with sperm and creates mucins that the males put in their nests, we see that the garters are actually investing much more in this prostate gland than are the sneakers. Julie also did some nice work on hormones and found that their hormone profile is completely different. Sneakers have the same hormone profile as a female. They have really high testosterone, but low fish androgen 11K ketotestosterone, which is the normal androgen that male fish have and creates all those secondary sexual characters that we saw, like the black color and the really puffy cheeks. She also looked at their sperm density. And for the same volume of milt under the microscope, the sneakers had tons and tons of sperm. The density of the ejaculate was way higher in the sneakers than it was in the garters, which is what you can see in the second slide, the density in an ejaculate, in the same volume of ejaculate. Okay, what about how many there are and how do contaminants play a role? Well, in general, we see that there are more garters than sneakers across time. There's actually been an increase in the number of garters across Hamilton Harbor over time. And interestingly, in cleaner areas, we have more garters, and in more contaminated areas, we have more sneakers. Well, are sneakers successful? Do they actually get any paternity? Do they actually, when they dump their sperm and run away, are they actually stealing any fertilization from these parental guarding males? And this was a question that a current master's student of mine, Riyad Malik, wanted to address. And so what Riyad did is he built a whole bunch of artificial nests and he placed them out in Hamilton Harbor. And they were lined with these acetate sheets. And then when he found that they were covered with eggs, he'd stuff the entrance with a sponge and he'd bring out the dad with his babies. He grew up these babies in the lab and then he dissected out the embryos and he genotyped them. He used something called a microsatellite analysis, genetic markers, to figure out who's the dad of these babies. And he did this about 38 times. And what he found was that the vast majority of the babies belong to the guarding dad that he could DNA and figure out, you know, the paternity from. And about 10% he had to assign to these sneaker males.
So the sneaker males are being successful. They are fathering young. They're not fathering as many as the garter. But remember, the sneaker male leaves and can go to another nest, and another nest, and another nest, and another nest. So it's possible that over their lifetime, or even in a single reproductive season, they may be very successful at fathering many, many offspring. So it could be an incredibly successful strategy. As I said, we're a behavioral lab, and we're really interested in behaviors. And so a past master student of mine, Katie Shinishin, set out to figure out, are they different in their behavior? Can you tell these animals apart simply on behavior? So she had a whole series of different assays, and I'm just gonna show you one. What she did in this one assay is she asked, who's more bold? We left them in these beautiful black shelters, which they love. We opened up a door remotely, and we asked, when do they leave this lovely shelter and explore a well-lit arena in the lab? And you'll see garters on your left and sneakers on your right. And the garters took much longer to leave these shelters than the sneakers. In general, we found that the sneakers were way more active, they swam more, they were more exploratory, but they were less social. They approached others way more cautiously and more slowly. I'm very lucky because I'm married to a wonderful mathematical biologist, David Earn. And along with him and a wonderful student, Jen Young, that we co-supervised, we explored how these different male types influence what happens in a population. We look to see how does the presence of these sneaker males influence the population, size, abundance, density. And this was through mathematical modeling. And what you can see on this graph is an area of green that shows that the round goby in Hamilton Harbor are very, very likely to continue to persist. The black dot refers to what we can measure about these gobies in Hamilton Harbor, and it shows that certain persistence is very likely for this population. If we could get it to the point where there were really, really few of these garter males, or lots and lots of sneaker males, the population could go extinct. But we think right now that it's very likely that this population will always remain and will continue to be persistent, sadly. So in summary, the garter males and sneaker males are the second part. The garter males are these bigger fish. They have these large accessory glands, also the can be thought of as the kind of prostate of a fish. They're way more aggressive. The sneaker males have much denser ejaculates, way more sperm per unit milt or ejaculate volume. They're bolder, more exploratory, and very active, and they are successfully fertilizing. And I should also remind you that they're more common in our polluted areas of the harbor. So what? Why should you care about this little invasive fish species? Well, it's continuing to spread. It's spreading northward. It's spreading southwards. And this fish is something that we need to pay attention to because, as I said, it's a species with impact. It affects the higher levels of the food web, but also the lower levels of the food web and the general community that it finds itself in. So I started this whole talk by kind of discussing two pretty depressing topics, a polluted harbor and invasion, right? Invasive species, not happy topics. But I want to kind of end on a happier or more positive note. And so I'm going to stress how far we've come and how much things have gotten better in Hamilton Harbor. We still have a long way to go. There's still a lot of problems to deal with, but we have made some very significant strides in the last, decades. So I want to remind everyone, there's been an incredible shoreline revitalization, right? The waterfront trail didn't exist. We have amazing parks like Bayfront
and Pier 4. We have a much nicer waterfront today, and there's plans for making that even better. The city of Hamilton has, over the last decade, invested a lot of money in building 9 additional overflow sites for that wastewater that they can't contain when it rains a lot. And there's been incredible amounts of investment, $340 million plus, of upgrades to the Woodward wastewater treatment plant. And this is really going to reduce the nutrients that enter the harbor. Also, Randall Reef has received a ton of money as a huge dredging and containment project. And we think that in the long-term future, that contaminated sediment is going to, the sediment's health is going to see massive improvements in Hamilton Harbor. So those are all very expensive things that the city, the province, the federal government has done. You might be sitting here and wondering, well, what can I do as a single person? Well, there's lots of things that you can do, and some of them are super simple and super cheap, and it won't cost you anything, maybe a little bit of time. And I'm just going to sort of share with you some thoughts that I have about what we can all do to make things better. One easy thing you can do is simply try not to use your laundry, your washing machine, your dishwasher, have a shower. Just use a lot of water at a time when there's a lot of snow melt, a lot of rain outside. Just wait till it dries out. You're not going to put as much pressure on our wastewater treatment plants. That's an easy thing we could all switch and do. Another thing all of us do is we travel. We go to another part of the province, we go to another part of Canada, we go to other countries. When you come back, make sure you clean your gear, because you don't know what you're bringing with you. Certainly you don't want to be bringing plants and animals from other countries, because they could become established and become an invasive population that we don't want, but just clean your gear. Don't bring stuff as stowaways that you don't want. All kinds of things can be on your gear. Another thing we can all do, and we probably do this, but just remember, tell your friends, tell your family, maybe not everyone does this, but don't dispose of chemicals improperly. Don't put pharmaceuticals down the toilet. People did this a lot in the past. You know, take it to the pharmacy, they'll dispose it for you. Don't put paints and other things down the drain. These are all things we know and love to think about, but not everybody does. And another more expensive thing, for sure, but definitely feasible, is think about your property. Think about the permeability of your property, your patio, your back, your stairs, your pathways. Making water slow down and so it goes into the ground and not down the sewer is actually something that's very helpful. Having a rain barrel, those kinds of things, having a rain garden. And finally, there's volunteer opportunities. There's volunteering with the RBG, with planting native plants. There's also all kinds of community cleanups by various organizations, including BART. And with that, I just want to end with a huge, huge thank you to the many, many people who made this possible. I have lots and lots of students that I've worked with over the years. I've also worked with great scientists at the Canada Centre for Inland Water, Department of Fisheries and Oceans, Environment Canada, the RBG, are a huge partner in a lot of this work, and so is Hamilton Water, the wastewater division, and of course to the many funders who made this research possible. And I'll just end with, do you have any questions for me? I think I saw a question from Rob. Nope, okay.
Yeah. And when we have these questions, I will, because we're making a recording of this, I'll repeat the question from the audience member.
Sure.
So the recording catches it.
That's perfect.
That's why I came up. You can handle a Q&A, but so go ahead.
In one of the early maps, it appeared that Lake Superior had been less invaded than the other Great Lakes. Is that because of the depth of the water and the coldness of the water? I'm just curious.
So the question is, just for the purpose of the recording, is that the map showed less penetration of Lake Superior. Is that because Lake Superior is so deep and so cold?
So we're currently in my lab doing a lot of experiments on thermal tolerance, high thermal tolerance and low thermal tolerance. And what we're finding is that the very small juveniles who've just hatched are very sensitive to low temperatures. So we think that that might be some kind of barrier northwards, but we're not sure yet. We're still kind of collecting the data right now. And what is really interesting is that they seem to be able to acclimate. So if we keep them in really cold water, they typically do better and can get a bit lower. But if they come from warmer water, like the shallow part, the littoral zone, and then have to deal with deep, colder water, they don't do very well.
Good question. David. So the question, I said, okay, David, and there were two Davids. I know you're both.
We both have the same question.
Yeah. So the question is, just to repeat for the recording, why does the one that is such a poor swimmer end up being so successful?
So I have two answers, and I think they're both correct. The first is that we have moved them. So they are used as bait fish or have been used as bait fish a lot. And so fishermen have moved them fast and wide for a while. And then it was sort of, there was an educational campaign given to fishermen and it stopped. The second answer is that they move more than we thought. So even though everyone predicted that they would stay put, it turns out that they will move. And they seem to move a lot when they're younger. So everyone had done all the work on the adults. And nobody had looked at these early life stages. But those early life stages seem to move a lot. And really interestingly, I have a current student who's working on something called dial vertical migration. Every night they go up and then they come down. And then they go up and then they go down. Which is crazy for a fish without a swim bladder. Like zooplankton that they eat, they move up and down. But it's very energetic, and we're trying to figure out how they do this and how it influences their growth. But they move way more than we think, and this movement upwards in the water column from the ground is probably how come they got trapped in ballast water. Because the ballast water doesn't go down, way deep, you know, 25 meters. It really takes the water from under the ships. And it was probably these youngsters that were moving up to either get away from predators or get to good food sources that they caught in the ballast water. But nobody thought about the youngsters. They were all looking at adults. Hundreds of papers on adults, zero on the early life stages.
Yes.
Fantastic question.
I missed that. The sneaker males are, what was it?
Do sneaker males make sneaker kids?
Ah.
And do garter males make garter kids? And do they grow up to be garters? Do their sons grow up to be garters? Do the sons grow up to be sneakers if their dad was a sneaker? Until this year, I would not have been able to answer your question. But this year, we ran an experiment in our lab where we let sneakers be sneakers, do their sneaky stuff, and then we take away the garter and we see what happens. And in a small proportion of cases, the sneakers will become garters. When there's no competition and there's lots of fecund females around to have sex with, they will take over a nest, start guarding it, turn black, even though they're little, change their hormone profile. So we think it's a flexible strategy, but we didn't know that till this year. So thank you for asking that question. It's the first time I've been able to answer it.
Great question. Really, you had a question.
That was my question
that was her question too. I was wondering the same thing, so good thing you asked. Who else has a question they would like to ask? So the question is, he had never heard of sneaker males or two different kinds of males. Does the same thing happen in other fish species?
There are hundreds of fish species that have sneakers. And we think that there are so many in fish for a few reasons. Unlike us, fish continue to grow throughout their lives. So there's more competition between a small fish and a big fish because a big fish could be 20 years old. Unlike us, when we reach puberty or a few years after puberty, we stop growing upwards. Maybe we keep on growing this way, but we don't grow this way. Fish continue to grow. So there's a lot more competition between the older animals and the younger animals. So that is a selective evolutionary force to have an alternative means to reproduce. If the females all want the big guys, and you're never going to get any action as a small guy, maybe this is your best bet to get something. The other reason fish are very common, or sneakers are very common among fish, is that they're external. Many of them are external fertilizers. So there's just an opportunity to dash in. It's not an internal fertilization. They can just, from the outside, squirt sperm on the eggs and get away with it. And thirdly, believe it or not, many, many fish species provide paternal care, male care. And so if you're a sneaker and you get away with not taking care of young, you get away with a lot. You don't have to put in that energy into looking after babies or even courting females. And that's something that you see in a lot of fish species. And you do know fish species that have these. Salmon species, jacks, are sneakers. Have you heard of the word jack before? It's a precocious salmon, a salmon that matures really early and doesn't ever turn into that big, like, hook nose, beautiful male. So they exist in many, many species. Sometimes it's genetically determined, usually it's environmentally or socially determined.
Another good question. Yes, up top. Okay, so the question is about the life cycle of the fish. How big do they get and how long do they live?
The oldest fish we've ever aged is 6 years old. We have very small round goby in Hamilton Harbor. In Lake Ontario, the fish are bigger, and if you go to Europe, they're monsters. So we are really happy when we have a fish that's around 10 grams. But in Europe, they're commonly 50, 60, 70 grams. And they eat them there, and they fish them for food. We don't do that here. And it's almost like a tank effect. Like, in the harbor, they're smaller than in the lake. And I don't know why, but they're small here. Maybe because of the contaminants. And they're getting smaller.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Does the garterfish ever attack the sneakers?
Oh, yes. They hate them. They chase them. And we didn't know if they detected them as a male or if they just thought they were another female and thought they got lucky and they had more than one. But in fact, they know it's a sneaker. They behave very differently to sneaker males than they do to females. Maybe they smell different. Maybe they behave different. We're trying to figure that out. But they will actually kill them if they can. They'll grab their little heads and they'll fling them out of the nest. They're not nice to the sneakers at all.
Don't invite them over for cards?
No, they don't invite them over for cards.
Susan.
Going back to the two pictures that you showed at the beginning, do you have any idea of approximately where the artist was?
Where in terms of Hamilton Harbor? I think the picture by Elizabeth Simcoe was taken from Burlington Heights, looking at the harbor, sort of like where the York Street Bridge, you know, that vista. I think that's, when I look at it, that's what I feel she was painting. I don't know that I've read exactly where she painted that. I wish I knew. But I feel that that's where, it just looks like that spot. David's agreeing with me. Thank you.
Yeah, if I can find, yes, she
She was at Richard Beasley's establishment, which is where Thunder Castle is now. And the other painting, if I can, that's actually looking west from roughly Macassar Bay toward Burlington Heights. You can, if you look closely, you can see where the railroad cut is on Burlington Heights. So
I'm trying to get there. I have too many.
West toward Queen's Paradise past Burlington Heights.
Aren't we lucky to have David Galbraith on our board from the RBG? An expert speaker, expert audience.
So where do you think this is? Because I thought it might be somewhere near Princess Point.
No, no, this is looking towards Queen's Paradise from Hamilton Harbor. There's a little gap in the distance. That's the railroad cut.
Oh, okay. I see it now. Yeah, definitely.
Queen's Paradise is beyond that.
Right.
So we're looking kind of toward Dundas in the far distance.
Yeah.
I really have another question.
Yes, that's correct.
So as we rehabilitate the water, we're going to get more around those.
Good question. So the question is, if the fish are in, the ones they're testing are in contaminated water, but we know the quality of the water is improving, will the goby problem become worse?
That's a great question. We don't know. We hope that we'll continue to be funded and that we can answer those questions, but right now we don't know.
Yes?
Does the goby fish go through the fish weir at the...
Does the question is, we know that of the fish trapped there at on the waterfront trail underneath the high-level bridge, do the gobies pass through that trap or they turn back is the question?
No, they definitely get past it. The one thing that helps coots from gobies is that they don't love soft sediment. They need a hard sediment like rock or log to lay their eggs on. And so they prefer that kind of shelter. They will bury themselves and they will go into soft sediment. They are found there, but it's a little bit of a natural barrier for them.
I'll go one, two, so go ahead. So the question is, in Hamilton Harbor, do we know how far a single goby might move within its lifespan?
We did a large mark recapture experiment where we captured over 1,000 gobies and marked them and looked to see how many we could recapture. And out of 1,000, I don't know, 100 fish that we marked, we caught something like 218 again. We caught most of them in the same season and very, very, very close to where we caught them the first time. There was a little bit of movement to other areas, but not very much. They were pretty much there. What's interesting is as the season progresses and it gets colder, it gets too cold for them in the littoral zone. So they move deep and then they come back. But even when we caught fish the next year, we caught them almost in the same trap that we initially caught them in. So they seem to have some kind of homing ability or return to the same areas or don't go that far offshore, really. They just go to some sort of warm pocket just in the, you know, a little bit further than the shallows.
Good question. You go ahead.
Can they survive in salt water?
The question is, can the goby survive in salt water?
It's a great question. In the Baltic, it's a brackish sea, and they are able to live in not fully marine conditions, but in, you know, brackish conditions, quite salty conditions. And there is some thought that one of the barriers to successful reproduction and successful sperm motility is the salinity level. So they might be able to survive, especially with some adaptation, but their sperm are not very good in that salty water. And that's all work that we know from Europe and from collaborators in Sweden and Norway.
Good question. We'll take a, go ahead.
Are there other areas in the Great Lakes where they're studying the goby that's similar to what you're doing?
Are there other areas in the Great Lakes where other scientists are studying gobies?
So unfortunately, the two other scientists who are very active, were very active in studying the round goby, are now retired. One is in the Trent Severn area, a gentleman called Mike Fox, who was at Trent University, and he's retired. Some of his students have started working with us, and we go up there a lot to try to figure out what's going on. And there was another wonderful researcher at Windsor who was studying them in Lake Erie, and she retired as well. Right now, the other big researcher who's working on round goby is a man called Nick Mandrake, and he's at the University of Toronto, and we collaborate a lot. He's studying them around the harbor area of Toronto, and we study them also in a harbor, but it's Hamilton Harbor, so there's a lot of parallels.
I'd like to ask a question of my own.
Please.
I'm a sport fisherman myself.
Okay.
I note that you said you released the gobies that you have studied.
No, we're not allowed to release them.
Oh, good. I thought you said you kept the same one more than once.
Sorry. The mark recapture experiment we did, we got special permission from the Department of Fisheries and Oceans and the Ministry of Natural Resources to do that with a certain number of animals, just so that we could see what happened.
See.
But normally you're not allowed to do that. It's against the law to put them back. But we got permission that 1 year to do this experiment.
Right, so I recall reading in the literature from the Ministry of Natural Resources, if you happen to catch one,
you're not allowed to put it back.
You're supposed to destroy the fish.
Exactly.
And that's another way that people can help.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. I should have put that on my list.
It was kind of a clue to me that gobies were here for good when I started seeing goby lures in the tackle shop that were imitating gobies. It means
I haven't seen those.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I'm not a fisherman or a fisherwoman.
You're probably really good at it, for all you know.
I can think like a fish.
Yeah. Okay. Was there one more question?
Oh,
sorry, I didn't realize there were more questions. I wouldn't have jumped in. Sorry, I see you up there now. Are gobies having an impact on the population of zebra mussels, is the question.
So I can't tell you what's happening in Hamilton Harbor, but I can tell you that our work in the Trent Severn region suggests yes. So they go through this lock system, and it's really easy to see their impact, and because you can kind of see that they've decimated that lock's zebra mussels, and then they've moved on to the next one. So I think that they do move when they finish the food in one area and move onwards.
And your seatmate has a question also. So is there a difference in when you look at different contamination levels, is there also a difference in the success of fertilized eggs in hatching?
That's a wonderful question, and I don't have the answer for that question, but I'd love you to come to my lab and work with me on that question.
Oh, and one more question up there. So the question, as I understand it, is that if there are sneakers that become garters, what happens next?
Is that telling me that the garter form is the more important one?
Oh, well, yeah, right. So which of those two is more important to the survival of the species overall?
So in evolutionary thinking, we don't think about a species surviving, we think about individuals surviving. It is definitely the case that without any garter males, nobody will reproduce. Because without a garter male, there's no nest, there's no females attracted. The sneaker wouldn't have anyone to parasitize without the garter there. So they're doing all the hard work of creating a nest, guarding the young, and without them, the eggs just die. They get full of fungus and they die without their dad to fan them and look after them and clean them. So the garter males are absolutely essential. They don't, sneakers are not, but they might be here to stay.
Very good question. You know, among humans, I wonder who the sneakers and garters are. Are the sneakers driving Corvettes?
I think you can make that analogy maybe with sperm, but very little else. Yeah.
Well, what a great set of questions because of what a great talk you gave.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. I've had a great time.
Thank you.